Well, welcome everybody. This is the second of our series. Can you hear me, or should I? Is it better if I sit down? I'll sit down. Okay. So, oh yes, that's much better. So, welcome everyone. And this is the second of our series of events, which we've organised around our yearbook, the Global Civil Society 2002, which is here. And as a special offer to people who come to these events, we're offering, if you buy one of these, you get last year's free. So this is my little plug right at the beginning. And we'll go on selling after the lecture's over. So if you want to go and buy them afterwards, you can. So that's my plug. But the thing I really want to say is that we're here. There's a wonderful chapter in this by Helmut
and Nuno.
And Nuno. Where's Nuno? Over there. which is about new organisational forms and the ways in which NGOs are changing in our globalised world. And it's really interesting, and Helmut's going to present it today. So Helmut, for those of you who don't know him, has been until this week the director of the Centre for Civil Society here at the London School of Economics, and the yearbook is a joint project of ourselves at the Centre for the Study of Global Governance and Helmut. He's alas just left us to join the University of California in Los Angeles, and we're going to be very sad to miss him, but it's going to be the start of a wonderful new LSE, University of California, joint program on social globalization. So with that, I'll hand over to Helmut.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I will stand, and I'll stand because I have to read the screen here. And you will see projected behind you pretty much what I will present. And I was at a talk the other day, and at the beginning of the talk, rather than at the end, the speaker thanked all the people. And I thought it was really nice, and I decided to do that as well. So what you see here are some of the people who contributed to the work that I'm going to be presenting. It is in many ways, it's about three papers in one. One of the chapters, or one of the papers, is indeed in Global Civil Society 2002. It's a paper with Nuno, who's sitting right there. There is a second paper that comes in almost at the end, and that is a paper I'm actually no author of, but I'm stealing one or two of their charts, and that's a paper by John Clark, who's also at the Center for Civil Society, and Nuno. They looked at data courses and new organizational forms that are emerging or developing, and forms that are internet-based or web-based types of organizations. And I will have something to say about that. And the third paper is very much a policy implications paper, and that asks the question, what does this then all mean for the way in which we try to forge or find out new social organizations that are above the nation state, but also very, very closely relating to the emergence of some of the organizations that I'm talking about here. So lots of people involved here, and that's one nice thing about the yearbook, and if you allow me to say that, it's a collaborative effort. And in all my professional life, I haven't had a better group of colleagues where it's more fun to work with, and they are listed on this table. So let me start by pointing out to you what I really think is a very, very crucial finding that we perhaps took for granted, but we haven't theorized it a lot, and that's the significant growth in the number of international organizations. On this chart, you see the number of international NGOs, we call them INGOs, going back to the year 1900, and you see that until about the late 1940s, not much happens, and there's a little blurb, as you can see here, but then it goes on. But somewhere in the 1970s, it really takes off. In about 1975, there is a new development going on, and then since the 80s and the 90s, a significant growth. Now, the question is, what is behind the growth? What are the drivers of the expansion, and what are the implications for the management of NGOs, particular transnational NGOs, And what are the implications for policy? This, in a way, is what this presentation is about tonight. More specifically, what I want to address is our 5 points. Is it filling a void? Are these INGOs occupying the space that is opened up by something that is retreating? Or is it more like a pushing? Are these INGOs pushing into new areas, covering and developing new grounds? For example, at a national level, in this country as well as in others, we talk about the state retreating. Now, are these NGOs doing something similar at the international level? Is there a void around perhaps the UN system that is not taken care of? There's no international government as such. What are NGOs doing in that way? Then the numbers are increasing. You've just seen it on the chart. Does that also mean greater complexity? Third, are we dealing with a quantitative expansion or is there a qualitative change involved as well? Number four, are we in fact seeing the beginning of a fundamental shift in organizational form? Are we going to see something new? And what does it all mean for power relations and policy regimes at a local level? So are we not only seeing something new, is it also something different? Now, to give you the answers in staccato, yes, it is a bit of both. It's filling and pushing, but at the moment it's more filling than pushing. Number two, yes, we have an increase in the number, but what is really happening now is a qualitative change that I want to look into a bit more. Are we seeing new organizational forms? I would say yes, indeed we are. And number four is the policy implications. This is perhaps the most complicated part of the talk, and I would like to return to this very much at the end. It's a bit of a speculative part of this presentation tonight. Now, when we use terms like INGOs or NGOs, we have to keep in mind that there's a great diversity in organizational forms. We have very large-scale charities, Oxfam, we have religious organizations. Some of these religious organizations are very well-established, they're very old, they're very hierarchical. Some of them are less so, they're less institutionalized. I think the difference between the Catholic Church and Islam is a very good one in terms of institutionalization. We have advocacy groups, we have service providers, we have movement organizations, we have networks. So please keep in mind that when I say INGO, that in fact there is a great variety of forms that are being addressed, and depending on what form we talk about, we may come up with a slightly different diagnosis. But what I would argue is that INGOs, with all their diversity, characterize a particular organizational form, and organizational form is a slightly technocratic term that's used to signify the characteristics of an organization that make it distinct and that also group it with others. So, example, we talk about service providing nonprofits versus advocacy nonprofits. Or some NGOs, I use nonprofit and NGO synonymously, provide services, others are primarily advocacy organizations. Now, they have in common that they're nonprofit in status, but they differ in their activities. And it's very often the interplay between the organizational structure and the field in which they operate that's of interest to organizational analysts. And we often find what is more important is the field in which you operate more important, such as education, or your form, that the fact that you're in a public institution versus a private institution. Form matters. It matters a lot. I will in a moment present you with an example. Throughout the organizational life cycle, NGOs change. Many NGOs are somehow based on movements, be it secular movements, be it religious movements. They then assume organizational status. They solidify, and while doing that, change form. A great field for people working in organizational studies is very often the fit between the structure of an organization and what is called the organizational task environment. If you have very unstable task environment, with a lot of uncertainty, then certain types of organizations are not very good, in particular a bureaucracy. But if you have stable environments and you pretty much know how what you have to do, then the bureaucracy is the best way. So looking at the type of environment in which you work in has implications on the kind of form and the structure you would like to occupy. And there are other elements that have to do with form and the choice of form that I won't go into here, like the legal environment and the like. And the basic features of NGOs and INGOs is that they are private. These are the key form characteristics with all the diversity they have. They're private, so they're not instrumentalities of government. They're non-profit distributing, so whatever they, whatever surplus they generate cannot be used as income to owners, and whatever liabilities they have incurred, it cannot be used privately as well. So they're self-governing, they're in charge of their own destiny, they're formal, so they have some form of identifiable structure, and they're non-compulsory in law. Now, of course, there are many, many borderline issues, and we should be aware of that, but in my talk, I will not be able to touch on that. There are INGOs that are very, very close to business, and in the field, we tend to talk about them as for-profits in disguise. There are commercial entities that use the INGO form. There are political issues. Some foundations, for example, are in fact extended branches of political parties and are very close to the state. Some think tanks are similar. And along the military border, I think if we look at the role some Islamic charities played in recent months, if we look at how the IRA, certainly in some East Coast cities in the United States, uses certain NGO-type formations to collect money, and there are other classification problems as well. But form matters, right? Regardless of the definition problem we have, regardless of the classification problems around NGOs, form matters. And I think the case of Jubilee 2000 is very instructive. I'm sure some of you are familiar with Jubilee 2000. It was initially very much in the social movement genre. It adapted the social movement form with very little central coordination, dispersed resources, and decentralized information management. And this was very good for the growth period. Right? And but once it had 24 million members, and there was much disagreement on what it actually means to be a member, what it means to be inside or outside the boundary of the organization, organizational problems of all kinds set in. There was overreach, there was mission dilution or goal displacement, as organizational analysts call it, and then conflict set in, scapegoating happened, and the chronic failure to detect problems in the organization early and leading to dissent. In the end, I think it's probably fair to say that the lack of control in an organization like Jubilee 2000 reduced its effectiveness and perhaps ultimately also its legitimacy. That's a good example where an organization fails to change form as it develops. So it's a kind of life cycle example. Now, what do we have then in the traditional NGO field? They tend to be headquartered in the north. London, New York, Paris, Geneva, Brussels, Amsterdam are the NGO capitals in the world. They have affiliates in several countries, but typically those countries are within the OECD. Operations, if they work in north or south, operations are in the south, so they would be in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Pronounced resource dependency, so resources, that's funding, expertise, flows north-south. But legitimacy problems, information problems. There's very often a hiatus in information flows and in awareness between the southern part of the organization and the northern headquarters. It's also quite hierarchical. It's many older established NGOs are modeled after bureaucracies, and I'll have more to say about that in a moment. And the politically effective stakeholders in traditional NGOs were in the north. Even if the operations were in the south, what really mattered, the people you had to keep happy, were maybe the foundations in New York, or maybe certain political affiliates in other parts of the country. So the new emerging NGOs are different. And a lot of my presentation from now on will be trying to understand why are the new and emerging NGOs, INGO, different from the old. The new emerging NGOs have multiple headquarters structures. They move from single headquarters to multiple headquarters. I'm not saying that all of them do, but we see a greater frequency of multiple headquarter organizations. They tend to be federations rather than unitary organizations, with an emergence of what we call a network type of organization. And I will come back to that in a moment as well. A great amount of experimentation goes on. The most of the experimentation has to do with decentralized forms of organization. So the operations are now in the north and in the south, and the stakeholders are both north and south. You can also say east and west, depending where your focus is. But at the same time, there's a continued questioning about hierarchy, about the very nature of centralized control in organizations, persistent resource dependencies and revenue dilemmas. Revenue flow problems persist, even in multiple headquarters structures, and that involves complex legitimacy issues. And I will return to those issues later on. So the first finding is that we have seen a significant expansion in the number of INGOs, and there are indications that tell us that something fundamental is going to happen, or is happening. The second point I wanted to make is about differentiation. So we have an expansion, but also whatever expands is qualitatively different. Now, I just want you to look at this chart, this table for a second. These are data from the International Association, the Union of International Associations in Brussels, and this is their classification scheme. And they classify organizations by what is not a very useful category, it's the IGO. These are federations, almost private entities created by international governmental organizations. There are very few of these, as you see. And then a large category are membership-based INGOs. Right, like Amnesty International would be a membership-based INGO. And then there are other special forms. These are largely the non-membership-based INGOs. They would be more like corporations. They would be like foundations. So they would not have members. That's a big differentiating line. And then we have subsidiaries, the dependent organizations, and then a large number of national NGOs. These would be national NGOs that have a significant international interest. And then that gives us a total, which you see here, which is now 25,000 almost, and then a relatively large number of unconfirmed, dead or inactive, unclassifiable organizations. And when you're an organizational analyst like I am, what jumps at you is, of course, that what they cannot classify is almost as big as what they classify, and that is a problem for them, and it's of interest to me, because what you see over time, this is the same data percentage, what declined relatively are the membership, the more traditional types of NGOs. You see they increased in absolute numbers, right, from 4,220 in 81 to 6,300 20 years later, but relatively, as you can see here, we see a decline from 44% to 25%. At the same time, we see an increase in non-membership-based forms. Right? Later on, I'll come back to that, and I say we see a corporatization of the NGO field that happens. We see a slight expansion also in the number of subsidiaries, which means it's an indication that existing organizations are getting larger and more complex. And that's an indication for what I later on call the network organization in the NGO field. And now, almost half of these organizations are not classifiable, or they don't quite know what is going on. And I think that is a very significant finding, because as they globalize, INGOs expand both within existing as well as into new forms. And I think that's what we saw in those tables, as rough as the classification scheme is. But it seems to point out that growth happens both within the categories that we have. There are more membership-based NGOs, there are more non-membership-based NGOs, but there's also an awful lot that we don't quite know. Whether it is an organization, are they active, are they inactive, how do they fit in? So the general thesis that Nuno and I try to outline in this in the paper that is in this book is really what you see up here, that the tension between needs and opportunities and the constraints of existing forms create a push towards differentiation and innovation. And that leads to an awful lot of hybrid organizations, and ultimately, I would say, to the emergence of new organizational forms. So why do we then find the significant growth? First, there is a term in organization, population ecology in organizational analysis called carrying capacity of the environment. Like, how many NGOs can there actually be? How many can be supported given current resource structures? How many Amnesty Internationals can there be? How many Ford Foundations can there be? How many Friends of the Earth? And how large can they actually grow? That's the question of the carrying capacity. And we think that the carrying capacity of this global civil society, sphere of global civil society, has not been reached, that there is an awful lot of room to grow. So there is space for new organizations. But most of this growth is in non-membership forms. So it's cooperation rather than association, what we see at the global level. And another driver here are political opportunities. There's the spread of democracies. Most countries have freedom of association. There's a rolling back of the state. They're increasing the international forms as well. A significant drop in the cost of organizing and in transaction costs transnationally. Telephone calls have never been cheaper. And because of the internet, it takes very, very little to communicate with people around the world. In fact, communicating with somebody in Cape Town is as expensive as communicating with somebody next door to where you live. And so there's a great flattening in what distance really matters. The spread of English in the last 22 decades has certainly helped organizing as well, and generally favorable economic conditions. But at the same time, NGOs, INGOs, because they are non-profit organizations, have certain constraints attached to them. One is that they typically have multiple stakeholders. For those of you familiar with the field know that a lot of the management literature in the NGO field, in the non-profit field, is in fact about how do we manage diverging and very often conflicting interests different stakeholders have about the mission of the organization. Now, INGOs have the same problems. What is more, their stakeholders, their constituencies are geographically separated, sometimes at great distances, which invites all forms, all sorts of information problems. They work in multiple jurisdictions. They very often have to work in multiple cultures. And they have to meet different governance and accountability requirements. And all of that happens with a general mismatch, typically, between needs and resources. The resources are in the north or in the west, and the needs are in the south and the east. Now, it sometimes helps to step back and make some very simple observations about the civil society organizations and NGOs as a non-profit form, because we know from economic theory that non-profits, and NGOs are just another form of a non-profit, exist under certain supply conditions. So we need to have a supply of what is called here social or ideological entrepreneurship. So we need people in a society, in a country, that are willing to make the effort. So we need activists. But we also need the skills that go with it. We need the human resources and the finances. I think it would be a safe bet to say that, particular in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been an unleashing of entrepreneurship around the world, largely because it's easier to do it, and largely because there are fewer political restrictions on for becoming active. And then there are demand conditions, and the demand conditions are many. I just list three. The first one is heterogeneity. If there's a lot of demand heterogeneity for quasi-public goods, and at the same time we have a fund shortage, then typically non-profit solutions arise and NGOs are created. We have voice problems in populations, that certain population groups find it difficult to be heard through the normal political process. It's also an indication of heterogeneity in a country. Then NGOs step in. And finally, there are significant information asymmetry problems very often around social service provision and trust issues. So when these conditions are there under normal circumstances, we find an increase in the number and, of course, the economic importance and social importance of NGOs. But NGOs have something in common. That's part of their form, and that's a persistent revenue problem. NGOs typically want to provide a quasi-public good. Because if it weren't a quasi-public good, if it were a private good, you probably could do it through the market. But we want to provide a quasi-public good. But if you do that, then pricing is often very difficult. So it's very difficult to put a price on a released prisoner, for example. And you invite all sorts of free rider problems. So people have an incentive very often of not contributing to it. Many NGOs, knowing of this significant revenue problem after they reach some scale, follow two paths. The first path is the production of a non-preferred good, something of a necessary evil that they do. For example, a museum has a museum shop, and the only reason we have the museum shop is because we make money with it that we can then use to display artifacts and whatever we really want to show. But otherwise, we're not really interested in running an arts shop or museum shop. Or they go for direct subsidies, so they try to get money from the government or from corporations or from foundations. So you get a third party to help you. But whatever revenue strategy you use, you are inviting problems with it, being that you have different stakeholders that you now have to take in. Most foundation money doesn't come without strings attached, and you have to live with the strings. Most government grants don't come for free, so to speak, but you have to meet certain requirements. If you engage in a significant degree of cross-subsidization so that you have a for-profit center which helps you then run your organization, that leads to tensions. It can be highly innovative, but you will also get into political problems in the sense that people say, well, the emphasis on commercial activities in organizations really crowding out what we are all about. And so you have a goal displacement, and very often, sometimes if you accept government money, that leads to a taming of the organization because you have to take your funding requirements into account. So NGOs or INGOs, like all organizations, and that's why the reason why I'm going through this, have to address issues of power. And I'm just listing some that are very, very critical principal agent problems. There are economic issues around revenue and increasingly competition, and there is environmental uncertainty. And it is very often an overlooked fact, I think, that we think the NGO field does not know competition. There is quite a bit of competition, it just takes different form. It's not only about material resources, but it's about members, it's about influence, and ultimately, I would say, it's about survival of the organization and the relative fitness of the NGO. Now, I'd like to take this thinking even into a more general perspective and think about form development more generally. How do organizations develop? And the history of organizations, be they government bureaucracies or be they corporations or NGOs or even the Catholic Church, typically points to four or five key areas. The first one is that of scale or size. How big has the organization to be relative to what it wants to do? The question of economies of scale comes into place. Then scope, how generalized or how specialized do we want our organization to be? And that's economies of scope. How do we manage authority, power, information, leading to the question of decentralization and centralization of tasks, flexibility and stability, and ultimately, how much autonomy do we allocate to what units in the organization? And looking at the development of organizations, maybe going to the 19th century, whether it was a government, whether it was a business firm, or whether it was a non-profit organization, most of them were unitary organizations. They were highly bureaucratic. Then, and this is the work I'm referring to Chandler here, they developed into multi-divisional forms. So we moved away from hierarchy and strict lines of authority to a more diversified structure, and now we're moving to a network organization. And what we have is that the unitary form was more hierarchical, it was more centralized, it was also more predictable, and it was a relatively stable type of organization. What we are having in the beginning of the 21st century is an organization called a network organization that is flexible, that has a lot of autonomy, and that is multi-unit. And the argument that we are making is that NGOs too are going through a cycle, in a way a parallel cycle to that of some of government and a parallel cycle to that of the business firm. By moving from highly hierarchical organizations, right? Just think about the way the Catholic Church was organized in the 19th century, and or the way many other larger religious organizations and religious charities, the Salvation Army, are organized. They are a unitary bureaucracy, and they are moving to ever more flexible network structures. And perhaps the dark causes that I spoke of at the beginning are an indication of the most extreme network forms of organizations that exist today. Virtual organizations based on the internet. This is just one example. It's taken from Chandler. In 1925, only two of the largest US firms were a multi-divisional form. By 1999, 84 were. Right? And a multi-divisional form and a network form in particular puts a premium on efficiencies of scale and scope and flows between units. And information does not only flow up to headquarters and down again, but you have a lot of lateral movements and delegated decision making. So we move autonomy and authority from headquarters to local areas. The latest development in the business world, and I would argue in the NGO field, is the network organization. And in particular for INGOs, it gives them the advantage that they can work globally, they can really have a global network, at the same time adjust to national or local conditions, so it allows variation. It allows for the lateral move of information where it's needed. It allows different forms of partnerships to develop at the local and regional level. It distributes authority, so you do get scale without an increase in bureaucracy. And it all adds up, I think, to greater diversity and adaptability in a problem solving. And here are some structural forms that we see. We still have corporate, relatively centralized associations. Human Rights Watch is a fairly centralized organization, as is the Catholic Church. Then we have federations, Amnesty International, Rotary, the Anglican Church. We have confederations like Oxfam, more informal network, I mentioned Jubilee 2000, and then a whole range of social movements. Very often social movements are not quite organizational, but they are, when successful, typically on the way to creating organizations. But there are persistent governance issues in all INGOs, independent of what form they have. And I think information flows, aspects about accountability, leadership, and decision-making issues, these are some of the drivers that push NGOs forward. And it has been said that some NGOs, it has been said for Amnesty International in particular, that it is, or they are, in a constant mode of reorganization. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that many of those organizational issues have not yet been solved. And there is a surge procedure going on in many INGOs, same in the business world, to find better organizational forms to fit the task environment. The third finding is to look specifically at form developments. So I'm moving away a bit from organizational theory to the world. Oops, the very end here. To go very, very quickly. Nice maps. Form developments. So there are new organizational forms. What we see is a pronounced emphasis on federations and something that is called the bumblebee structure. And I'll say more about that in a moment. Then we see experiments with the way headquarters relates to affiliates or to affiliate organizations. There's a lot of innovation that goes on there. And third, and I mentioned it already, are the internet-based dark causes. they reflect a differentiation in global organizing based on IT innovations and associated cost reductions. So what we have here is the international campaign to ban landmines. And if you like the maps, you also find them in the yearbook. So they were produced by a guy, Katz, who's absolutely a devil when it comes to map making. It's very, very good. And it's a very simple radial structure and with a single headquarter, and it's fairly centralized. Now, and it was also quite a successful organization. I'm not making the case that all the successful organizations are the highly decentralized one. It just depends on the task that you are dealing with. Sometimes centralization is the best way, sometimes decentralization is the best way. But you would say that this looks very conventional. You could have, in fact, a franchise system that has a headquarters sometime, I think that must be in New York, and then you have all those little outlets around the world. It would look very much the same. Now here we have the forum on early warning and early response. It's still a very, very simple structure. We have now affiliates or associates and support organizations, so there is a bit of a differentiation in the way the organization operates, but still a single headquarter, and this one is largely based in Europe, whereas the other one was US-based. Now here we're getting into more interesting arenas, still a bit more complex, single headquarter with a transnational steering group and a working group. So this is very typical for a multi-divisional structure. Right? Whereas the first, this example is very unitary, this is now becoming more multi-divisional. So we have more lateral moves of information in these organizations. And here we have regional headquarters that's still one step further. We devolved authorities, but we don't have one single headquarter. We have regional headquarters with national committees, and the structure becomes more of that of a federation. Right? And a federation has numerous advantages in terms of information management and adaptability, as I mentioned earlier. And finally, we have the most complex one, and the one I really like, this is the Climate Action Network. You have multiple headquarters, a highly complex design, it is a federation, it's highly decentralized, and it is potentially moving into what we call a network organization. Right? A network organization, one without a single center, it is multi-centered, and it's fairly well spread around the globe. And each of these, and that's where you see the advantage, each of these subunits can be organized somewhat separately and somewhat differently. So you take advantage of local adaptation. The Bumblebee Federation is given this particular name because it involves an interesting and I think ultimately quite promising interaction between headquarters and affiliates. And in this structure, the affiliates are given increased power if they prove their reliability. So once you become an affiliate of such an INGO network, at the beginning, you'll be scrutinized very closely. And you will be asked to report frequently. And there's a lot of requirements in terms of accountability and transparency. But once you prove your point, you're given more leeway. So as you become more reliable, then you get more autonomy, you get more voice. And so there is an incentive structure built in here that is around trust building and voice and autonomy. And that's quite successful for those organizations that practice this. Of course, if you become unreliable, then at the worst, you turned into the equivalent of administration or receivership. That headquarters would then in a way, almost take you over and establish central control. But if you run the organization very efficiently, you have a lot of autonomy.
Why is it called a bumblebee?
Because a bumblebee flies back and forth, and if it comes back with honey, it's allowed to fly out further and longer. So, and then we have a new development called the DART causes, and that's really not my paper, but it's a paper that John Clark and Luno have been working on. And here is the idea that we're moving away, that we're slowly moving away from what they call brick and mortar organizations to what they call clicks without borders. And so that these organizations become virtual organizations, and that they're very often event-based. They are almost ephemeral. They're certainly not very persistent and permanent type of movements or organizations. And they have a number of very interesting organizational issues around them. The first one is that they don't seem to depend on leaders. And I must tell you, as an organizational theorist, I have a hard time accepting that, because so much of organizational theory tells us that organizations over time tend to develop more hierarchical forms of leadership. And it could well be that we don't find leadership emerging in these dark causes because they don't exist long enough. Were they to exist longer, we would see hierarchical tendencies. They are virtual organizations, and there's not a lot of face-to-face time. And I think Nuno and John Clark worry what that means for trust building among members and for continuity. And there's very little planning and very little long-term strategic thinking, which means, and this is also taken from the work that Nuno and John did, that we can think of these new dot causes as a forum of movements rather than as perhaps the movement itself. There is a certain carnival effect that people have identified, and a tactical free-for-all. And we had several events last year in 2001, and I'm not talking about September 11, but I'm talking about Geneva, where things got a bit out of hand. And whenever you don't have some form of leadership and centralized control, the potential for violence is always greater. Key finding number four, and that then brings me to the last part of my presentation, is to think a bit about long-term policy implications and a different possible future for INGOs. This is also the most speculative part of the talk. And let me begin by answering one of the questions I answered at the beginning. So are NGOs changing? Are they here to stay? I would definitely say yes. NGOs are here. They will probably continue to grow significantly. But the question is, growing into what? And growing in what context? That's what I want to focus on now. They're quite different policy scenarios. We have the weakly coupled and the weakly centered international political arena, as I'm sure you all know. Economic globalization is expanding. When the US and China and the European Union have very, very different visions about what an international welfare regime, if any, should look like. And there is a continuing value structure gap in global civil society, to which I come at the very end. So I would probably venture the hypothesis that we will see an increased professionalization of INGOs, that we will see an increased commercialization of INGOs. Will lead to a differentiation in some big players. Some of them will be similar to mini world banks versus smaller NGOs and dot causes. That's clearly a differentiation that we can identify. But what I wonder is, what kind of a society does that then imply? If we have more space for NGOs than we ever had before, probably in the long, or certainly for the last 60, 80 years, what kind of a society does that signify? And if we have ever more NGOs that work above the national level, what kind of a global civil society does it signify? How does it relate to whatever government entities we have, and how does it relate to the business community of transnational corporations, and the governments, the international governments, such as the UN system and the European Union? And I've thought about four scenarios that I wanted to share with you, and in a different setting, we are exploring those scenarios also at the national level as well. but I think it's helpful to look at these scenarios globally. So we could have what I call a new public management scenario for NGOs or for INGOs, which emphasizes the service delivery component or activities of NGOs, not so much the advocacy part. But if we agree that we increasingly have a significant supply shortfall for social, economic, and educational health services of all kinds at a global level, right? And if we also agree that national governments find it increasingly difficult to do and they're not perhaps not that interested in it anymore, then couldn't NGOs, in one way or another, do something there? So you could think of NGOs as really a well-organized set of organizations, almost corporate entities, to take on tasks that were previously part of national state administrations or indeed the UN system, but are now delivered through a competitive bidding process on contractual arrangements. They're trying to maximize the competitive advantage of non-profit providers in these global welfare systems, but ultimately under some state or UN or IMF or World Bank, wherever, tutelage. So, in fact, we do at an international level what a Labour government is trying to do in the UK. We try to instrumentalize here the voluntary sector at a global level, we try to instrumentalize the NGOs into carrying out tasks that government doesn't want to do or can't really finance. Right? And we know enough about new public management how to do it. So you could really think of NGOs as the service providers at a global level in an area where we have economic globalization but a very weak form of international government. The second scenario in which you can think about INGOs is what I call the social capital scenario. And here, NGOs become part of this self-organizing sphere, almost of a globalizing quasi-state apparatus of a global society largely left to itself, and we think of it as benign, with a lot of individualism, but a lot of participation, perhaps with a moral consciousness that is global in its aspirations, and terms like connectivity and social capital come to mind. So in a way, we take the Putnam debate that we have in the United States and also a bit in Europe about the virtue of social capital and the virtue of self-organizing societies to the global level. And we say that NGOs are really an expression of that. And that's what we want to support. We have a minimalist national state and we have a minimalist and weakly integrated international arena of government organizations, with exceptions like the European Union. But in this area, in this field, we let NGOs do their bit. And then there's the liberal scenario, and it's almost Gellner's vision taken to the global level, that INGOs become a source of dissent, and they challenge, and they innovate, and they become this countervailing force that Gellner wrote about so well. Countervailing force against whatever international or world or government is there or is not there, and the increasing dominance in many spheres of transnational cooperation. So NGOs become, in fact, the moral conscience. They become the watchdog of the world and try to keep things in check. So Gellner's idea, Gellner's promise at a global level. So it's a very liberal scenario that we have here. And then this is the one I find most intriguing because I can't really make the greatest sense out of it. It's the corporate scenario. It's the most challenging, I would say, because it leads us to really think in a very different way. This is out-of-the-box thinking, and that's why, including myself, sometimes have a hard time getting into it. It really means that what happens in the NGO field could be an extension of the way in which we have a global business environment. Corporations, transnational corporations, rather than governments, which is what we are used to, that governments work and contract with NGOs, but a transnational government, transnational corporations use NGOs as service providers as part of their corporate responsibility programs. And that transnational corporations no longer really rely on governments to look into social and health and related problems of all kinds, but that NGOs become part of that. So it was previously the realm of government, healthcare, childcare, pensions, and even access to community services, increasingly moved into the corporate field. Entitlements are increasingly not linked to citizenship, but to membership, or to membership in particular corporations. And as you know, I've just moved, after 5 years, moved back to the United States, and it always is interesting to find that access to healthcare and even access to certain educational goods and services is contingent on your membership in a corporation. It doesn't matter whether you're a citizen or not. What matters is that you are part of a corporation. And these corporations, of course, see the advantages of NGOs as agents to reach out to communities. Of course, they do that different from the way governments do. They do it with a very selfish motive in mind. So which of these scenarios will come through? I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine, but I think the fourth scenario is the one that will keep us busy in 10 to 15 years from now. There is a structure value gap that I think we need to be aware of. The expansion of global civil society, if we take NGOs as part of that, was largely an expansion of the infrastructure of global civil society. You remember the first slide I showed you where we had a tremendous expansion in starting with the mid-70s. We had this very intriguing differentiation within NGOs. But what has not happened is that other parts of civil society, global civil society, expanded at the same level, at the same rate. If we look at how tolerant people are, the respect they have for diversity, the respect they have for others, these data, and there are a lot of shortcomings about this data, of course, they're very flat. People have not, in the last 10, 20 years, become more tolerant in a significant way or more accommodating of differences. But what has happened is that we have more organizations in this global civil society. So membership levels have not necessarily increased in most society. What has increased is the number of membership organizations, so that we are ever more frequently member of smaller units rather than of the bigger units that characterize particularly the early part of the 20th century. And aspects of and measures of volunteering are also fairly flat. People don't volunteer more than they did 20 years ago. And so we had a significant expansion of the organizational infrastructure in the NGO sector, but not something not matched by an expansion in the way we look at values, particularly around civility. So the next step in this kind of work is really to look more into the form characteristics. We need better classifications of NGOs. The structure value gap is something I'd like to focus on more. And how innovations happen, particularly in the area of data causes and what it means for basic building blocks of civil society, building blocks such as membership and participation. So let me leave it there, and thank you for listening and look forward to the discussion.
I'll just give everybody a little chance to leave, who wants. Rather a lot of people are leaving. We're not ending, we still have a discussion. So now I'm going to, oh dear. Who would like to ask a question? Yeah.
measure when society is saturated with these institutions, when there is little space?
The question was, when he spoke of space for NGOs, how do you know whether NGOs are filling a space at or when the space is still growing? I mean, how do you measure the space?
Well, you can measure it in different ways. One is legal. Is it very easy, for example, to establish an organization? Do you need permission to establish the organization? If not, then you have space to begin with. Another one is to look at the economic resources that you have. Are there resources for your organization? Or do you have to take the resources from somewhere else? So there's a lot of competition for it. And then there's the demand side. Is there a need for the organization? So you think of the legal environment probably as that gives you a basic framework, and then it's one of supply and demand for the space. And I think at the moment, the argument in the talk was that we don't quite know how big the space is, right? But we know that there's certainly a demand out there, and that because of the significant cost reductions in global organizing, we have a rosier picture on the supply side.
Okay, now several people had their hands up. Oh, I can't see it there, but if there is one over there, that's...
Okay. Well, this is kind of basic. It's regarding terms. How would you define confederation and the differences between confederation and federation? I'm sorry, I don't know the difference.
Yes. A confederation is usually when two separate units, right, create an umbrella body. And a federation is when they are all part of the same unit. Right? Whether you have separate entities or the same entity. Like the European Union is moving ever closer to a confederation, whereas the United States is a federation.
Yeah. The gentleman over there.
Hi. How will NGOs, particularly transnational NGOs, be regulated? In particular, what will keep them from becoming corrupt if they become really powerful?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the persisting problems that we have for those larger networks on those federations, because they work in multiple jurisdictions. And there are different principles. What is typically very common is the headquarter principle applies, so the organization's headquarter in, let's say, in London, then the accountability would be according to British law, but prevents them from becoming corrupt. We often say that these organizations are very deeply entrenched in values, and you get a certain kind of person working for NGOs relative to work for organizations like Enron. But because of the sorting mechanism, you have a somewhat lower propensity for corruption, for corrupt behavior in many NGOs than you would have in other types of organizations, where there is really a moral hazard to take advantage, to the greatest extent possible, of the area in which you work. So I think there is a bit of a sorting effect that protects it.
But let's say the NGOs really do become powerful, and perhaps they amalgamate and become more, you know, a bit of a... What kinds of checks and balances do you see coming to regulate NGOs or to be a counterbalance to NGOs if they become really, you know, powerful stakeholders in the bargaining process?
I think it depends what kind of NGO we're talking about. If it is a foundation, an independently endowed foundation, then we have a significant problem in public oversight. And foundations have a democratic deficit because they don't have owners, and they have a perpetuate the board of trustees. They do not have the equivalent of shareholders, they do not have the equivalent of membership that keeps the organization in check. So for foundations, I see a significant need for some form of, I don't want to use the term global regulation, but for some forum by which foundations are accountable to some body or to some organization. At the moment, they are only accountable within national legal contexts. If it is a membership organization, then we have a slightly less acute problem when it comes to democracy. Because if it is a membership organization that has democratic membership principles built into it, then you could say that the membership will keep the organization in check. What I don't want to see happen is something of a, maybe an international legal status is needed for NGOs, but there would be some jurisdiction looking after those bodies that really work globally. And I think we're a long way from that.
Yes.
Thank you for a very stimulating talk. What I you mentioned one or two political organizations, the IRA funding in America and Muslim charities, particularly now when there's so much in the news about international terrorism and the American war on terror, where they list certain NGOs and list them as terroristic organizations, and they try to, I think, stop their funding or seize their funds. Though, as you say, sometimes people campaign in America like the IRA. These are problems which I think might grow as you, particularly with the growing influence of the Muslim world, Palestinian charities, and in Indonesia one or two organizations seem to be raising funds and being listed. What type of problems do you think will occur, and do you think other governments other than the American will start prescribing organizations they consider politically hostile? I'd be most interested in your views. I know it's a complex question, so...
Well, I think in a way it relates to your question, is that as NGOs become more powerful, as they become financially more powerful as well, there will be calls for greater regulation. And in particular, if you have highly publicized events like the Islamic charities, which I find also interesting, because for decades we have known that the IRA does fundraising, certainly in New York area and in the Boston area, and it is somehow, it works through charities. We did not get as upset as we are now apparently about some Islamic charities, but most of the Islamic charities are certainly not political in the sense that some of those fundraising organizations were, or they are cover organizations for really political movements. They are political parties in disguise, or even paramilitary groups in disguise, but they are a tiny, tiny minority. So I just put that up as to indicate that there are problems around borders. And those problems around the border, whether it's a political border, whether it's a commercial border, and I think the commercial border matters in the end much more than the political border when it comes to NGO, that we should not keep those, but we have to keep that in mind.
I'm going to take two at once, and then those. So I'll take you two, and then we'll go...
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. I come from an international NGO background, and there's a lot of word today about nationalizing international NGOs. And I'm interested in knowing whether what are the problematic issues around moving from an international structure and framework and becoming a national organization? Because, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of implications on, you know, the kind of work that is being done and so on. What is the logic if there's a trend, and is it possible? Is it a kind of structure that you think, or a kind of movement that you think is worth venturing into?
Yeah.
And just before you answer, I'll take the other question too, because we're...
Okay, thank you very much. I was just wondering about your four scenarios there. I'm not sure actually that I completely understood all four of them, so I'm going to buy the book. And hopefully that will help me to understand that those better. I guess my question is, you said you're not sure, you know, you can't say which one of those four will prevail, but I'm wondering if you think that, you know, of necessity, one of those will have to prevail, or if, you know, you said earlier form is important and form sort of follows function, so could there not be a mix of those things? And also, what kind of timeline are you looking at? Like, some of the things up there, I was like, because I'm also from an NGO, international NGO background, and some of the things that I saw were really, I don't know if I've been living with my head in the sand for too long.
Both questions are interesting. Let me take the first one. The nationalizing of, and Nuno, please feel free to come in if you know a good example. The nationalizing of international NGOs is part of this phenomenon that we describe as network organization. Because what happens then is that you devolve the organization from an international headquarters structure to more local units. And the reason you want to do that is largely around information management and resource maximization. You would find it easier to waste the resources locally and to intervene locally and use local knowledge without having to go through this big loop and asking for clearance in New York or in Geneva. So it's one of economics, but then it's also one of legitimacy, because I think in the NGO field at the moment, particularly in the international NGO field, there is a certain backlash against what is seen as the dominance of Western-type NGOs. So nationalization is almost like a delayed decolonization of the NGO world. You could look at it this way from a political perspective. I think it's probably a good movement if it fits the purpose of the organization. You see, there are some organizations that are best organized fairly centrally, and they best sit at where the center of power is, so that you organize an organization in, within the OECD, because that's where you can move things like the movement against the International Agreement on Investment was largely one driven by the West, but it would have affected everybody, and they did it very successfully. Had they nationalized too much and decentralized too much, they would not have been as successful. So I see that as a part in the way network organizations are evolving at the moment. So if your organization is, let's say, one that was born in the 50s and 60s, and it was probably still very much in a bureaucratic mode. If you looked at the NGOs that were registered with the United Nations in the 50s and 60s, they all looked like boring 19th century bureaucracies. They all looked the same, but they're now becoming far more varied. I think that's something I wanted to share with you, that we see really a blossoming and a great differentiation in organizational forms at the international level. Now, to your question, these four scenarios are caricatures. They overstate a case. In reality, there's going to be some mixture of it. But we do have some, and I come from, you might say, from the non-profit field, from the NGO field. We do have some interesting question to ask. What is the purpose of all of this in the end? In what kind of society do we want to live? Or are we going to live if NGOs continue to grow, if transnational corporations continue to expand, but if national governments continue to shrink, and if we continue to live with a weakly coupled international system? There are several scenarios that come to mind. So that's the background to these.
Now we have this lady here.
Yes, people on the left.
Oh, there are people over there that I can't see.
I would like to know how you see the future of NGOs in authoritarian countries, as being part of an NGO can be very risky in some parts of the world, let's say China or a small country like Tunisia. So how do you see, will NGOs be able to keep ahead of the modern communication systems used by governments too? Or do you see the future for them rather bleak in this kind of governmental systems?
I have a very positive view when it comes to those autocratic countries. I don't know Tunisia, but I know the Chinese situation a bit simply because I've been to China several times over the last couple of months, in fact working with the Chinese government on how they can legalize and, in, I would say, modernize, open up their legal system to make it easier for NGOs to operate. Now, the Chinese government, when they say NGO, they don't have the NGOs in mind that you and I may think about. They see NGOs very much in the arena of what I described as the new public management scenario. They want to decentralize government functions. They know exactly that they will have a huge demand for social and welfare services of all kinds just waiting around the corner, and they also know that they cannot meet those demands. So the Chinese government is using NGOs, service-providing NGOs, as a means of modernizing government and coming up with an early response to a crisis in social services that will be there in about 10 to 15 years. And I also believe here, not in the sense of a hypothesis, this is my political conviction, that you can only do this to some extent before you invite different voices, before you have to let advocacy groups work and the like. And you have to liberalize freedom of association at some point. And at the moment, the Chinese government is very, very cautious in that. And perhaps this is for the better, I don't know.
We have a question there.
I wondered whether you think the growth of NGOs does imply a greater participation in civil society.
That's the puzzling question that I ended up with, that if we look at measures of individual participation across, and here we only have largely data for OECD countries, across OECD countries, those measures of participation have increased a bit, but they have not increased to the extent to which we had this mushroom of NGOs. So something is going on that we still don't understand. It's certainly not that everybody has become an activist. People are not necessarily more active than they were. It is just easier to do it and less costly.
And then there's a gentleman over there who's been trying to ask a question.
Sorry, you've got the luxury of being an academic and you've got time to analyse the structure of NGOs. Marvellous organisational picture you've given us. But you didn't get on to recommendations, because the NGO, people working for NGOs are up against it. They haven't got the time and the luxury to analyse the future. You've observed organic growth in the NGOs. Things are just, they're just getting on with it. And you've been able to sit back and analyse it and look at it. What are your key recommendations for those NGOs who don't have that chance to reflect as much as you are, say, your success analysis of NGOs?
Before you answer that, I'm going to take... There's a lady over there. And is there anyone else who wants to ask a question? I'm going to take the remaining questions so we can do a roundup.
Yeah.
Okay, so go ahead.
This is a question on definition. Your definition of NGOs seems to be a very, very broad one. It covers every conceivable organization and movement, anything that's non-governmental. But in the old days, there used to be a term called pressure groups, and I don't think you use that at all today. Do you see that as a much narrower definition, or... could that be used synonymously with your term NGOs?
Okay, and then there's a gentleman just there.
We look back a few hundred years ago at slavery and the genocide when America was colonised, and the NGOs didn't exist then. But we've got the benefit of hindsight to look at our development then and suggest that was wrong. I believe in a few hundred years we'll be looking, for example, at the AIDS crisis now and looking at how our development now didn't allow us to respond to those deaths in Africa. Can you envisage NGOs in a few hundred years, you know, if they keep increasing as the way they have, you know, how they would respond to those situations?
Okay, and then we had there, and there was a lady there, wasn't there?
My first question is, what do you mean by dependent NGOs? It was one of the classifications. And the second question about donor factor in the increased number of international NGOs. In particular, more and more international organizations as institutionalized the NGO policies and participation policies, and as a result, there are more donor-created NGOs and NGOs created as a requirements of the donors, in particular, to meet requirements for funding. How you consider this process as a positive, or what is your opinion on this? Thank you very much for the presentation.
And then I think the last one is the lady there.
I've got a question about the relationship between the type of funding an INGO receives and its enthusiasm for criticizing the human rights situation in countries where they have programs. Would it be fair to say that if international NGOs receive less money from membership and have to rely more on funding from governments, they'll clearly be less interested in criticizing the situation they find in countries, and therefore it could simply progress to a situation where they are observers but not they don't actually mouth any protest because they're so conditioned by the money that they rely on.
And I think I'd just like to add a couple of questions myself. I'm sorry, I think we've come to the end of the questions. I'll add a couple and then let Helmut reply. My couple of questions is, one is in the line of the last two, which is, to what extent can you work out how much of this increase is actually due to the fact that more and more governments prefer to give money to NGOs than carrying out certain functions themselves? And certainly we know there's been an enormous increase in development assistance which goes to NGOs rather than is spent directly. So how much is it just a donor-created phenomenon? And my second question is, these changes in form, what you didn't say was, what is it about the global environment that drives these changes in form? Is it transnationalism, having to operate across large distances? Is it the growth of information technology? Is it greater individuality and complexity of modern life? What is it about? Do you have any intuitions about what it is about the global environment that has created these, that has necessitated these new organizational forms?
Well, Nuno, do you want to add something?
I don't know, I just said that this idea about the future scenarios are actually quite real.
Can you also think of recommendations for the gentleman back there?
Recommendations. I think nationalism idea is very important, but I think there's a legitimacy, perhaps, above all. There's a growing trend of nationalizing international NGOs, making you locally rooted. You have to be locally rooted. And I think that's an inevitable trend. You can't avoid that, really. I think that's very perceptible. But you have to make sure that you do that responsibly. So you nationalize the the systems, the capacity, as well as the monitoring and education that there might be stuff that the national organizations can actually do as well. So I don't know, one good example is the branding of the reputation. You don't want
let me thanks, Luna. Let me just go through the various questions very quickly, because I know time's not on our side. Recommendations. I hesitated first to even pick up the question, and because recommendations are best done in a specific circumstance. And one credo of organizational theory is that there has to be a match between the organizational structure and the task environment. And unless you specify the task environment, it's difficult to tell you what structure and what way of management is the best. But keeping that aside, I would say moving to something like an N form, the network type of organization, is the way to go with multiple revenue structures or revenue sources attached to it. So you need to avoid resource dependencies to the extent possible and have a devolved organizational structure. That's what transnational NGOs, I would say. Right? If you're really rooted nationally and you just have some international interest, then it's a different story. You might well be best off being a more conventional, multi-divisional organization. Then your question about pressure groups, it is very similar to what I refer to as advocacy organizations. So organization advocate for a particular type, be it political, be it economic, be it social, be it cultural. So pressure groups would be part of that. But many of the theories that we have in the field are in fact not driven by advocacy thinking, but they're more driven, because they come out of economics, they're driven by service provision and particularly around social services and delivery systems like that. The question, I think it was you about how would the genocide in the American in the Americas of the 1800s happen today? Yes, of course they would in a different. Yeah, but I think the larger part of it is that it's close to the social capital scenario that I described. That if we think of these network types, NGOs, as an early warning system for all sorts of social ills in society, right, then that's the vision you have. So what happened in Mexico with the Zapatistas, blow that up to the global level, and this is the scenario that I think you have in mind. But it's a different story whether it would prevent a genocide from happening, but I'm not an expert here. Mary's much more versed in these matters. You had a question back there about subsidiaries and dependent organizations. These are simply NGOs that are unitary but do have a branch office in another country. And that branch office is not a dependent unit. It depends on what goes on at headquarters. And as we saw, these have increased as well. You also had a question about whether we see whether this expansion, it relates to Mary's question as well, is donor-driven. Yes, to some extent it is, particularly in the delivery of development services of all kinds, but also social services. It is, at the international level, something that we find at the national level as well. If we have a significant expansion of the voluntary sector in this country, of the non-profit sector in the U.S., or go to any European country, right, you see a growth, significant growth in NGOs and non-profits. And much of it is driven by a mechanism that's called third-party government, where a government, and that's the one of the scenarios I pointed out, this is the new public management scenario, that we simply take that to the international level. So governments no longer deliver, they only partially finance, but what they do is largely steer a process that is based on quasi-markets and competitive bidding. And it's not necessarily only bad. And there's lots that can be said for this type of organization. Then there was... Do I have all the questions from the audience, or did I miss one?
There was a human rights question.
Yes, I didn't write that down. What was it again? Oh, yeah, that's an intriguing question because it doesn't only come up in the relationship between funding for human rights organizations and how tame they become and that they shy away from critical issues. That is to some extent true, but in research that was not done at the international level, but was done at the national level, something very intriguing came out. They did ask social service providers, organizations that were attacking poverty in the inner cities in the US. We have non-profit organizations working there. And they found, in fact, that a lot of the organizations prefer government funding over any other type of funding because it's the most stable funding. And unless you depend on it for over, I think the threshold was up 40-60% somewhere in there. Right? It was funding that agencies said, well, because we have government funding, we can actually do the things we always wanted to do. Right? And that was to attack poverty. Because if they do have resource problems all the time as an organization, you spend your energies in raising resources and you don't get to do the things you want to do. So there's always, there are two sides to the story. But a human rights organization be totally dependent on government money is not a good idea. It reduces your legitimacy and you have stakeholder problems. And very often NGOs have to balance dependency on resources with on financial resources with legitimacy issues. And Mary's questions, I think, well, we can talk about it over dinner as well, but I think the drivers of these form changes, all of them happen to some extent, all of them are relevant. But in the last 10 years, I would venture the hypothesis, and Nuno, correct me if I'm wrong, that the last 10 years saw the expansion of NGOs largely because of a significant drop in communication costs and the costs of organizing globally. That's what made it possible. At the international level. And I think the first question you had is really a version of the new public management scenario.
You've answered that question. Well, thank you very, very much, Helmut. And thank you. I mean, it's really sad for us that you're going to leave, and we've relied on you so much in producing this, but we'll continue to work together in producing it. I want to just announce to everybody that this is part of a series. There are two more this term. There'll be another series next term. On the 7th of November, we'll have Professor Neera Chandoki, who's professor at University of Delhi. And she's written a chapter in the yearbook which is very sceptical about global civil society. She's very sceptical about NGOs. Some of the questions that people have said here about being donor-driven, she thinks they displace local organizations. She thinks that shouldn't be what civil society is all about. So she's written a really nice sceptical piece called The Limits of Global Civil Society. And so I do recommend you all to come. And then on the 21st of November, we have Professor Abdullahi Anaim, who is an Islamic scholar specializing in human rights. And he's written a chapter, he's from Sudan, and he's written a chapter on religion and civil society and the problem that Western secular civil society often lacks a dimension of spirituality that he thinks is important. And he talks about liberal Islam, about Gandhism, about liberation theology, but also about fundamentalism and extremism. And so that should be very interesting too, and that's on the 21st of November. So I hope you all come again.